Hi, this is Rabbi Jeff Sachs of Atida Noeb Yeshiva with our session on Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik's Halachic Man. Tonight's class is dedicated in memory of Mrs. Regina Hurwitz, Alei HaShalom. There's a picture of Mrs. Hurwitz, who I'm looking over her little biographical information about her here. It seems that this year would have been her 110th birthday, and it would have also been the 90th anniversary of her arrival in the United States. For our purposes at Web Yeshiva, one of her greatest accomplishments seems to have been her family, and specifically to us, although I'm sure there are many members of the family she was and would have been proud of, for our purposes, clearly her grandson, Ezra Hurwitz, who is the head of Web Yeshiva's tech support and is responsible for so many things that go right with Web Yeshiva, so much so that it's the kind of job that tends to go unthanked, unfortunately. And since tonight is the final session, at least of this semester, I want to take a moment to thank Ezra for being our Ezra, for being our help and support. And you know, the nature of those helping jobs, where if you're doing your job, things don't go wrong, so people don't even notice how hard you're working, should not be an excuse not to thank him for all of his work on behalf of all of us to keep this rather complicated machinery running, to allow the dissemination of Torah everywhere. And the dissemination of tonight's Torah should be in the merit of his grandmother, Mrs. Regina Hurwitz, Alei HaShalom, of blessed memory, Rivka Bat Avram Shlomo. But I want to also mention that the entire series of Halachic Man Shiurim, this past semester retroactively, and the upcoming semester in which we will be continuing our study of Halachic Man, is dedicated in memory of Rabbi Ezra Labaton, Zecher Tzadik Levracha. Rabbi Labaton was the rabbi of the West Deal Synagogue on the Jersey Shore. I had the privilege of meeting him and his wife and his children a number of times and talking with him about an array of issues. He was a student of Rabbi Soloveitchik in the most profound sense. He was he studied in Rabbi Soloveitchik's shiur. He was ordained by Rabbi Soloveitchik, but he was also a keen student of Rabbi Soloveitchik's philosophy and thought. And therefore, it's appropriate that these shiurim should be dedicated in his memory. If you look on the course page, you'll find more information about Rabbi Labaton, and we'll remain there throughout our study of Halachic Man, including a link to various other links and other websites, memorial websites, and links to his Divrei Torah and shiurim and lectures and talks on a variety of topics in Torah study, including Jewish philosophy. Rabbi Labaton was a leader of the Syrian Jewish community, of the Syrian Sephardic Jewish community on the Jersey Shore. And as you can see from the dates that are posted there, like sad bookends, he was taken from us all too soon, and his legacy of teaching and learning and study and questioning and thinking is an important one, and it's appropriate that we dedicate our learning to his memory, Zecher Tzadik Levracha. Again, I encourage you, visit that link, webyeshiva.org/Rabbi Labaton, in order to learn more about this really remarkable man. And this dedication was made by our students here at Web Yeshiva, Michael and Tiffany Beta, and we thank them for their support in memory of their great Rabbi Ezra Labaton. It's appropriate that we should have these dedications in memory of two such special people tonight, because, oddly enough, our topic is death, as you'll see. I'd like to try to do our best to get through all of Chapter 8 tonight. I'm going to skip a little bit here and there, and of course you're welcome to go back and fill in the parts that we skip. but I'd like to finish up through chapter 8 tonight, because as I mentioned, this is the final session before Pesach, and we'll be picking up again after Pesach, but there will be this little break of a number of weeks until we continue, but we'll be picking up where we leave off. Halachic man. We were talking most recently about, again, comparing these great characters, cognitive man, the scientist, homo religiosus, the kind of universal religious man, and the great figure that stands above and bestride them, halachic man, how each of them relates to the world, the created world, reality. And now we're going to look at how halachic man looks at the other world. And as I mentioned a few times, the other world isn't Olam Haba per se, but the world of the spirit, the world of the transcendent. Halachic man's relationship to transcendence, in other words, that aspect of principally religion that thinks it can take you out of this world, that can free you from the constructs of the created world. Because of the perceived inherent problem of being a spiritual being trapped in a physical world with all of the contradictions and tensions and challenges that poses, universal religious man, homo religiosus, sought to escape the challenges of this world. So how does halachic man view that? Halachic man does not long for a transcendent world, for supernal levels of pure, pristine existence. For was not the ideal world, halachic man's deepest desire, his darling child, was not the ideal world created only for the purpose of being actualized in our real world? In other words, halacha is the blueprint. That's what we were talking about at great length the past two sessions. If halacha is the blueprint, so it's a blueprint for our world. Doesn't the architect want to see the building built in reality? And we spoke about at some length the challenge between the pure, pristine, Platonic ideal and its necessary compromise as it's implemented in the real world. And I even mentioned that case that someone told me of a musician friend, told me of a composer who prefers not to actually hear his compositions played because the orchestra will never, the symphony will never get it, the right way that he would like it. We're often told about screenwriters, people that write screenplays, and not being allowed on the set. Because what happens? The writer writes the script, but in actuality, the actors take certain liberties, the director will change this or that or the other thing, for creative purposes, for technical purposes. This agitates the writers, and it causes tension on the set. So sometimes the writer will be banished from the set because of this gap between the ideal and the real. Not so halachic man. Halachic man understands that the ideal halacha, the halacha in the abstract, its only purpose is for the implementation in this world. Even though, and I'll remind you parenthetically of what we studied last week, that even though there are certain halachot which are not in fact actually implemented in this world, the ben soru more, the ir hanidachat, etc., but nevertheless, the overwhelming majority of the halachic project is for actual implementation, real-world implementation. So halachic man is concerned with this world because this is the world where the halacha plays itself out. It's the laboratory. It is this world which constitutes the stage for the halacha, the setting for halachic man's life. It is here that the halacha can be implemented to a greater or lesser degree. It is here that it can pass from potentiality into actuality. It is here in this world that halachic man acquires eternal life. And now there's a quote. Better is 1 hour of Torah and mitzvot in this world than the whole life of the world to come, states the Tana in Avot. There's a problem because this quote is not precise. It's not an exact quote. I'm not going to go into the details here. Most likely the Rebbe was quoting from memory. And this particular Mishnah in Avot, which the translator has identified as chapter 4, Mishnah 17, is not is not the precise quote. And the quote, as the Rav brings it, does not seem to actually exist. The actual quote in Avot is, Yafa sha'achat b'tshuva u'masim tovim. Better is 1 hour of repentance and good deeds in this world than the life in the whole world to come. If you look at the statement in the Mishnah in its context, it seems to actually undermine what the Rav is saying. How this is, why this is not our topic tonight, but I do feel it necessary to mention this. But the sentiment is correct. The sentiment that this world, our world, or the world where Torah and Mitzvot can be implemented, that's the purpose of creation. That's the purpose of the Jew. Not for the aspiration to get to the world's above. And this declaration is the watchword of the halachists. Not only will universal homo religious not understand this statement, homo religiosus will not understand the statement, but it will have only contempt for it, as if, heaven forbid, it intended to deny the pure and exalted life after death. For the universal religious man, this world is merely the stepping stone to get to a better world, the world to come. The story is told about the Gaon of Vilna, how just before his death, he clutched the tzitzit of his garment, wept, and exclaimed, "How beautiful is this world! For a penny, a person can acquire eternal life." Meaning that only here, through the performance of mitzvot, even simple mitzvot, like, let's say, wearing tzitzit, which is not a big sacrifice, and it's not a big deal, and it's not a big expense, and it's not a... For the cost of doing a simple mitzvah, one can achieve eternal life. And then there's another very well-known story about the purpose of doing mitzvot. A certain Polish woman of noble birth proved stubborn and demanded as a purchase price for the fresh green moist myrtles that grew in her garden the reward that was reserved for the Gaon for his performance of the commandments. He gladly and wholeheartedly fulfilled the request and transferred, as it were, to her the reward for the commandment of taking the four species. You know that the Lulav and Etrog and the Aravot and the Hadassim, the Arba Minim that we use on Sukkot, you know, now in Israel you can buy any of these things in any supermarket practically. And even in America they're all readily available, and probably throughout most of Europe. Not to such a huge expense. In the old days it was very expensive to get these things, I mean, unless you lived in places where they are naturally grown. But you know, in Poland, in Lithuania, you know what it meant in Vilna to get a lulav and an esrog? It was, you know, like importing something from halfway around the world. It was very expensive. By the time it would make its way to Vilna, it may have already been dried out. So apparently in Vilna there was one woman who had a myrtle bush, and she was the only one. It cost a lot of money. The Vilna Gaon actually was quite poor. He lived a life of apparently very serious poverty. So she, you know, not for any price was she willing to give these hadassim for use. But she told the Gaon that she would let him have, you know, these three sprigs of hadassim on the condition that she gets the reward for his doing the mitzvah. So he says, gladly. So the students were quite surprised by this. And he says, all my life I grieved. When would I have the opportunity of fulfilling the commandment without receiving a reward? In order that I might therefore fulfill the injunction of Antigonos Yishisokho. This is a Mishnah in Avot, in the end of the first chapter of Masechet Avot. Have mishamshim et harav shelo almanat lekavon pras. That one should serve the master, should serve God, not in order to receive a reward. In other words, we do believe in schar va'onesh. We do believe in reward and punishment. Halachic man's focus on this world over the world to come does not negate the belief in eternal reward. It just reorients our emphases and our ideas of what's essential. So whenever we do a mitzvah, even though we don't perform the mitzvah, why do we perform mitzvot? We perform mitzvot because we are mitzuvim, because we are commanded. But we're always at the danger of being motivated by a desire to receive the reward, which is in fact our due for doing mitzvot. So here the Vilna Gaon says, finally I can do a mitzvah without any concern that my motive has been adulterated by the desire for reward, since I've already given away the reward to begin with. That's the purpose of mitzvot, to be commanded beings and to fulfill our obligations in this world, whether or not there is reward in the world to come, even though, parenthetically, we do believe that there is in fact reward. But the halachic man is saying we'd be just as glad to do it without. Judaism has a negative attitude towards death. A corpse defiles, a grave defiles in the sense of ritual impurity, of tum'ah. A person who's been defiled by a corpse is defiled for 7 days and is forbidden to eat any sacrificial offerings, sacred offerings, or to enter the temple, etc., etc., etc. And we're aware that all different types of mitzvot are connected to this. When we say that the halakha, that the halachic man is not interested in death, is not interested in what happens to us after death, that is not to mean that we do not take interest in these topics as halachic topics themselves. As a matter of fact, tumah v'tahara, ritual impurity and purity, avelut, the laws of mourning, the laws connected with death, are themselves the subject of Torah study, like all other topics. And as we mentioned last week, part of the Brisker revolution, part of the Brisker innovation in Torah study was to domesticate topics that had been kind of left outside the pale for Torah study. And these two particular topics, Tumah v'Tahara, purity and impurity, ritual impurity, is one of these topics, as well as Avelut, mourning. As you know, Rabbi, this was a particular topic of interest to Rabbi Soloveitchik, topic of mourning, perhaps among other reasons, because it's an example of the category of halachot where there's a set defined objective criteria for ritual performance of the laws of mourning, but the actual fulfillment of the obligation comes about through kiyum shebalev, through an emotional component of how one feels and how one internalizes the outer ritual through their heart or through their mind. And this was a category of halakha, like prayer, like a variety of other topics, which was of tshuva, for example, repentance, which was a particular interest to Rabbi Soloveitchik. So these topics themselves are interesting as insofar as they constitute a heftza shel Torah, an object of Torah study, but in and of themselves are not a motivating factor, the idea of death. Death for the halachic man, Judaism has a negative attitude towards death. Many religions view the phenomenon of death as a positive spectacle, inasmuch as it highlights and sensitizes the religious consciousness and sensibility. They therefore sanctify death in the grave because it is here that we find ourselves at the threshold of transcendence, at the portal of the world to come. Death is seen as a window filled with light, open to an exalted supernal realm. Judaism, however, proclaims that coming into contact with the dead precipitates defilement. Judaism abhors death or organic decay, dissolution. It bids one to choose life and sanctify it. V'chai bohen. Authentic Judaism is reflected in halachic thought, as reflected in halachic thought, sees in death a terrifying contradiction to the whole of religious life. Death negates the entire magnificent experience of halachic man. I am free among the dead. Hamitim chofshi is understood by the Gemara to mean that being dead, niftar, the rabbinic nickname for the dead, niftar, means patur, exempt. By definition, those who are dead are no longer obligated in mitzvot, are no longer able to fulfill mitzvot. And that's why we have this custom of you know, when one is buried with a talit, we remove the tzitzit. So this is a widespread custom, although it happens not to be the custom in Yerushalayim, which is confusing to people that attend funerals here. But the widespread Jewish custom is that a man, at least, is buried with his talit, the uniform of the Jew, but the tzitzit themselves are removed, or the talit is rendered pasul by cutting off one corner, because a dead person is not able to fulfill the mitzvot. Halacha is devoid of any positive orientation to death and burial. On the contrary, it views these phenomena from a negative perspective. We'll skip ahead a bit on the middle of page 32. Here, the halacha is not at all concerned with a transcendent world. The world to come is a tranquil, quiet world that is wholly good and wholly everlasting and wholly eternal, wherein man will receive the reward for the commandments which he performed in this world. Yes, yes, all true, all very good and nice, but that doesn't really give us much to think about. Meaning the point of this world is to do mitzvot. And insofar as you and I presume if you're listening to me at some point in the future in the archives, you too, are still yet in this world, well, it can be rather spiritually distracting. I mean, this is not what the Rav is saying here, but it's part of his sentiment in a larger sense, that the focus on the world to come can be very spiritually distracting. It can cause us to do all types of things. It can cause us to skew all of our decision-making and our triage of values and judgments in this world. And think of all the excesses that have been committed in history in the name of religion, when religion had its eye focused not on the here and now, but on the next world. Think of all types of acts of terror, even in our own days, that were committed in the name of religion by people who are willing to martyr themselves because they're certain of the reward waiting them in the next world, and that's enough to justify any act in this world. And the Rav goes on here to say, top page 33, the task of the religious, you can understand why this whole worldview leads Rabbi Soloveitchik to a standpoint which, you know, really does argue for a kind of moderation, not a kind of radicalism, but a much more matun, a much more calm state of mind, a much more even keel. Not the kind of fundamentalism that is so synonymous with religion today, both within Judaism and without. The task of the religious individual is bound up with the performance of commandments, and this performance is confined to this world, to physical concrete reality, to clamorous, tumultuous life, pulsating with exuberance and strength. Therefore, holiness need keep itself far from death. The priest, the Nazarite, the temple court, holy offerings are all removed as if by an iron wall from the realm of death. And he mentions different categories of halakha which have a specific antithesis to death, where higher sanctity requires further insulation from death. And then he quotes the very well-known midrash. Holiness means the holiness of earthly here and now life. And then he quotes the well-known Agadah in Masechet Shabbat, Daf Pei Chet, Omer Bet, about when God is ready to give the Torah, the angels make a complaint that it should be given to the angels, and Moses' retort, well, what's in there? Well, you shouldn't do this, you shouldn't do that. Are you angels? Are you tempted to do these things? And in fact, they are not. And it's Moshe's argument that the Torah itself is designed for imperfect, sinning man with all of his shortcomings, that's the purpose of it. The Torah is designed to be implemented in this created world, not in some kind of perfect angelic sphere. God does not wish to hand over his Torah to the ministering angels, the denizens of the transcendent world. Rather, he handed over his Torah to Moshe, who brought it down to the earth and caused it to dwell among human beings. Now, the Rav therefore emphasizes why life is a central value in the Jewish worldview. The saving of a life overrides the commandments of the entire Torah, and he shall live by them and not die by them. V'chai bohem v'lo tam shetam bohem, says the Gemara in Yoma. It's better to desecrate one Shabbos in order to save a life. Gemara is dealing with the question of somebody who has a life-threatening illness, let's say, on Shabbat, which requires desecrating Shabbat. So obviously that overrides everything else, and it's better to desecrate one Shabbat and save his life so that he can go on and keep many, many, many more Shabbatot than to let him die. This law is the watchword of Judaism. An authority who allows himself to be consulted when life is in danger is reprehensible, and he who consults him, rather than speedily acting to save a life that's in danger, is a murderer, says the Torah, the halachic code. Meaning that when it comes to pikuach nefesh, when it comes to the saving of a life, that's the prime value. And you don't sit there splitting hairs trying to go like this, go like that. But better to just act and to get it done. I've been very fortunate in my life and career. I've almost without exception never been put in a situation where I've been forced to deal with these issues. I've never had to go to the hospital on Shabbat. All of my children were born, although one of them was born on Shabbat. We got to the hospital long beforehand and sat in labor for however long. Never had to, you know, it obviously happened. Probably one out of seven people are born on Shabbat by simple statistical analysis. And people have to drive to the hospital on Shabbat all the time to have babies, and unfortunately for less pleasant circumstances. And if I had to, I would go in a second. But all things being equal, I'm glad I was never put in that position yet, B'li'ayin Hara. But a few years ago, there was this strange case in our shul where a little girl from the neighborhood went missing on Yom Kippur. And it was a time here in Israel where there was some, you know, heightened worries, more than we have normally, and for whatever reason. And, you know, in the afternoon during the break, everybody went out looking for her. It turned out it was nothing. She was at somebody else's house playing, and nobody knew where she was, and the parents got nervous. Anyway, there was a bus, you know, like a public transportation bus that parks itself near our shul so that it's the first bus to head out on Saturday night. And there was a rumor that some kids had been playing with the bus or in the bus, that there was a way to get into it. And there's these emergency open, there's a way to open the bus door by pressing a button, and, you know, it's electric and the door opens. And there had been a terrible, terrible story here a few weeks earlier at the beginning of the school year, where a little girl had fallen asleep on the school bus and had been left behind, and the bus parked, and long story short, unfortunately, the girl suffocated on the bus overnight, and it was a terrible story. So everybody had this on their mind, and somebody said, the little girl, maybe she's on the bus, and she was there, and somebody else closed the door behind her, and it's a hot day. And so I pressed the button. I didn't think twice. It was not a problem. There was a plausible hunch that maybe this had happened, and somebody, one of the other kids, had said that maybe she was on the bus and they saw her playing near the bus. I didn't think twice to press that button. I didn't even like. Only afterwards did I start thinking that it's probably only a rabbinic. It's probably a rabbinic prohibition, not a Torah prohibition. You don't have to think twice. If there's a credible, serious threat to life, you don't think twice. And the whole standing there going like this with your thumb is in fact against the Torah's desires. Maimonides, that master of conciseness, deviated from his regular manner and treated this issue with great elaborateness. And he quotes the Rambam at length about the importance of, you know, when it happens that somebody, that some medical emergency needs to be dealt with on Shabbat. So the greatest person should be, don't say, well, let's look, maybe a kid can call. You know, like if you have to call Hatzalah, or if you have to call the hospital, or et cetera. You say, well, maybe there's a non-Jew, maybe in the shul there's the janitor, we can find him, and he'll make the call. No, you should, the rabbi should do it. In order to get it done and to get it done efficiently and to show that that they're tied, just like 99.999% of the time we upkeep the Shabbat, that in this case, this is the upkeeping of the Shabbat. This is the fulfillment of the Torah. The teachings of the Torah do not oppose the laws of life and reality. For were they to clash with this world and were they to negate the value of concrete physiological, biological existence, then they would contain not mercy, loving kindness, and peace, but vengeance and wrath. Even if there's only a doubtful possibility that a person's life is in danger, one renders a lenient decision. And as long as one is able to discover some possible danger to life, one may use that doubt to render a lenient decision. Then he quotes Reb Chaim, his grandfather, Reb Chaim Brisker, who was very famously lenient about fasting on Yom Kippur if there was illness. Reb Chaim famously said he's not lenient about fasting on Yom Kippur. He's stringent about the laws of saving a life. And of course, in those days, you know, and again, it's always proper to consult a rabbi. It's always proper for the rabbi to consult the doctors. But Reb Chaim was famously lenient, particularly in those days when there were cholera epidemics and typhus and all types of other diseases and things. So Reb Chaim was particularly stringent on these things. Temporal life becomes transformed into eternal life, becomes sanctified and elevated with eternal holiness. We've stated that Judaism, as reflected in Halakha, has a negative attitude towards death. A person is obligated to rend his garments and mourn for his relative. The Halakha has established certain units of time with regard to mourning. And then he describes an idea that he explains a number of times. That the whole system of avelut, the whole system of coming out of avelut, that when a person dies, it's the most severe, and then we have 3 days of more intense mourning, the 7 days of Shiva, 30 days of Shloshim, the 12-month period of mourning for a parent, etc. The preoccupation with the memory of the dead desecrates the holiness of the temple. Indeed, many Rishonim exempted high priests from all rites, and holiness is rooted and embedded in joy. Right? The Halakha understood that it has to wean you off of mourning, that the whole point of the rituals of mourning are to kind of allow you re-entry into the world. We don't negate the value of mourning. On quite the contrary, the psychology of mourning in Judaism is quite profound. But we also understand that part of the ritual is to help you re-enter a normal, joyful life, and that's why we have these periods of time with which we wean you off the mourning back towards more daily life. Joy is the symbol of the real life in which the halakha is actualized, at the top of page 36. Avelut, mourning, aninut, grief, the intense period between death and burial, however, are interwoven and bound up with that arch-opponent of holiness, death. Death and holiness constitute two contradictory verses, as it were, and the third harmonizing verse has yet to make its appearance. He's using a rabbinic metaphor of there are these two contradictory ideas. holiness on one side and death. And we don't have a resolution. This is built in, this tension is built into existence. The Gaon of Vilna, Joseph Dov Soloveitchik here, is the Rav's eponym, the person for whom he is named, his great-grandfather, also known as the Beis Halevi. His son, Reb Chaim, that's the Rav's grandfather. His grandson, Reb Moshe, that's the Rav's father. Reb Ilya Pruzhna Feinstein, that's the Rav's maternal grandfather. That's how the Rav and Rav Moshe Feinstein were cousins. I think they were second cousins once removed or something like that through the Feinstein family. The Rav's mother was from the Feinstein family. So the Rav says that his father is his two grandfathers, his great-grandfather, none of these Lithuanian Jews, these Litvaks, who were known after all, or stereotyped, I should say, as being, rather cold and emotionless. But none of them ever visited cemeteries or prostrated themselves on the graves of their ancestors. The memory of death would have distracted them from the intensive efforts to study Torah, meaning they would have been distracted from the this-worldliness of the halachic project. Interestingly, many years after this was written, the Rav himself did visit the cemetery, apparently quite frequently, to visit the grave of his wife, who died at a relatively young age. She died in her 60s, in her early 60s, I think. The Rav was a widow for the last 30 years of his life, and spent many of those years mourning for her. So just one of the ways in which the description of the halachic man, the ideal of the halachic man, did not always match up completely with the Rav's own personality and biography. The Rav himself may not have completely identified with this character that he extols in this work. It is only against this background that we can comprehend a peculiar feature in the character of many great Jewish scholars and halakhic giants, the fear of death. Halakhic man is afraid of death. The dread of dissolution oftentimes seizes hold of him. And then he tells this story that he heard from his uncle, from Mayor Bar Ilan, about Reb Chaim being fixated on death, being afraid of death. Reb Chaim is looking out, looking mournful, and Mayor Bar Ilan asks him, what is it? What's going on? And Reb Chaim says, I'm reflecting upon the end of every man of death. This fixation is almost paralyzing. I'm going to skip ahead to the bottom of page 37. The ideal of halachic man is the redemption of the world, not via a higher world, but via the world itself. Now, if you remember that chart that I displayed on the screen a number of times, this is precisely the difference between halachic man and homo religiosus. Homo religiosus looks to escape this world. This world is a compromised world. And homo religiosus, the general religious man, seeks to escape it, to transcend it in order to get to a more purely spiritual world. Halachic man understands that by bringing the Torah down from heaven into this world, we can redeem or repair the world that we live in via the adaptation of empirical reality to the ideal patterns of halacha, a kind of reverse engineering of creation. In other words, the architect looks at the blueprints, and then he looks at the building that the contractor actually made based upon his perfect blueprints. The composer looks at the musical score and then listens to the recording or listens to the performance. Halachic man looks at reality in the metaphor, the building or the composition, and tries to understand how it can be reverse engineered to meet the ideal halachic norm. If a Jew lives in accordance with the halacha, a life in accordance with the halachic mean, halacha means first the comprehension of the halacha per se, and second, comparing the ideal halacha in the real world, the active realization of the halacha. Meaning, to live in accordance with the halacha doesn't just mean to do the mitzvot, although of course it also means that. This is why when we refer to people colloquially as halachic men, as a means to say that they were people who were careful to do the mitzvot, well of course halachic men are careful to do the mitzvot. But that is not the meaning of what halachic men are, men or women, right? The halachic man is the one that looks at the world and finds the connection, the overview of real and ideal, of building and blueprint, and to make sure that there's hatama, that there's a match between them. Then he shall find redemption. The lowly world is elevated through the halakha to the level of a divine world. If a Jew cognizes, for example, the Shabbat laws and the precepts concerning the sanctity of the day and all of their particulars, if he comprehends via a profound study and understanding that penetrates to the very depths the basic principles of Torah law that take the form and color within the tract of Shabbat, then he will perceive the sunset of a Shabbat Eve not only as a natural cosmic phenomena, but as an unsurpassably awe-inspiring sacred and exalted vision, an eternal sanctity that is reflected in the setting of the sun. Again, this goes back to the beginning of the previous chapter where we talked about how halachic man perceives reality. If you've really studied Shabbat, Hilchot Shabbat, Masechet Shabbat, if you've internalized what Shabbat is on a halachic scale, then when you look at the sunset on Friday, you don't see just the sunset. You see that it's a transformation from chol into kodesh, from profane or from common or from daily into holy. It doesn't look like the sunset between Wednesday and Thursday. It's categorically different because it accomplishes, it inaugurates a halachic category of holiness. I remember how once on the Day of Atonement on Yom Kippur, I went outside to the synagogue with my father, just before the Ne'ilah service. It had been a fresh, clear day, and one of the fine, almost delicate days of summer's end, filled with sunshine and light. It's late in the afternoon on Yom Kippur. The fast will be over in an hour or so. Everything was fast approaching, and an exquisite autumn sun was sinking in the west. Beyond the trees of the cemetery into a sea of purple and gold. Now the Rav is intentionally being poetic here, right? In other words, he's telling you that he, Rabbi Soloveitchik, he had the soul of a poet. And he's being almost, I don't want to say ironic, but there is something ironic here. He gives this poetic description of the scene. The nature and the setting of the sun and the autumn and the late summer's day. A sea of purple and gold. And Rav Moshe, his father, the halachic man par excellence, turned to me and said, "This sunset differs from ordinary sunsets, for with it forgiveness is bestowed upon us for our sins. Itsumo shel yom mechaper." In other words, when the halachic man looks at the same sunset, the purple and the gold and the autumnal, exquisite autumnal sun, and he sees that this, with this sunset, with the passing of Yom Kippur, comes the forgiveness of sin. It's a halachic category. It's a halachic sunset. The Day of Atonement and the forgiveness of sins merged and blended here with the splendor and beauty of the world and with the hidden lawfulness of the order of cosmic of creation and the whole was transformed into one living, holy, cosmic phenomenon. Right? So, interestingly for the Rav doesn't negate the setting of the sun. The Rav doesn't negate the beauty, the autumnal splendor. But these two things, you see them both superimposed one on top of the other. Right? You see the sunset in all of its multi-technicolor glory, and on top of that you see the blueprint of the halakhic category. It's almost like, well, you know, like on on my phone, on computers, etc., you have like an icon. Right? The icon is a kind of abstract. You know, like on my phone, there's a there's a Zmanim program, there's a weather program, and or a Zmanim program. It tells you like when sunset is, and sunset is always the same. And the sunset is this little picture of the sun. And then, you know, like on the horizon. And then it tells you underneath it, you know, the number. It tells you, 5:49 is sunset. And then in the morning, oh, and there's an arrow going down. The arrow going down is like, it's an icon, right, to tell you that this is the sun setting. And in the morning, to tell you what time sunrise is, it's about. Now, this is not what the sun looks like. This is an abstraction of the sun. Right? This is an abstraction of the sun. Just like all those other little icons that they use in the weather programs, right, are abstractions. See, like a sun with like a cloud in front of it is meant to tell you that it's cloudy. Or a cloud with a lightning bolt coming out of it is meant to tell you thunderstorms. These are abstractions of reality to capture one element of what it is. But that's not the thing itself. But I guess if you're just the weatherman, that's all that's necessary. Or if you want to just know one particular fact, that's all that's necessary. So it's not that the halachic man need go outside and look and see only the icon, right? That like we can imagine with the icon, like every day has a regular sunset, every day has a regular sunset, and a halachic man goes out and on Yom Kippur, there's a different icon displaying on his screen, on a halachic iPod, on a halachic iPad, to show you that this sunset is different. No, you see the actual sunset, right? You see the splendor, you see the glory. Think of his memory. The Rav doesn't tell us how old he is here when this story takes place, but I imagine him being a quite little boy as this story takes place with his father, don't you? Doesn't it seem to you that he's right? He's not an 18-year-old here, right? He's a little boy holding his father's hand, and he sees the splendor and glory of creation, but then he also sees, perhaps here as a young boy, through his father's eyes before he can see it himself, the halachic category superimposed on top of it, on top of it. And that is the vision of halachic man. And through that, we can redeem existence. The universal homo religiosus proclaims, the lower yearns for the higher. This world, we want to escape it. We want to burst through and get to a different, get to a better. The halachic man, however, with his unique mode of understanding, declares the higher longs and pines for the lower. The Torah, or even maybe God himself, as it were, wants this world, because this world is the world in which the halacha can be actualized. And that is the agenda of the halachic man, to bring the Torah down into this world where it was meant to be actualized. We will end here with chapter 8. When we meet again after Pesach, we'll continue on as we have been until now, And for those of you that have been listening along by archives, you're welcome to catch up. We hope those that have been with us this semester will continue next semester. And again, we thank our sponsors, the Beta family, in memory of Rabbi Ezra Labaton, Zichrono Lavracha, for the entire series. And this evening, the family of Mrs. Regina Hurwitz, grandmother of our friend Ezra, Yehi Zichram Baruch, both of them. And only a coincidence that our topic today was about the importance of life in this world and what our mitzvot and good deeds in this world are truly worth for the purposes of this world. So thank you all very much for what was a very engaging semester. I appreciated learning from you and with you, and to all those that sent in such insightful comments and questions as we went along, I look forward to continue hearing from you. And if we don't speak again beforehand, Chag Kosher V'Sameach to you all.